Listening to the KPCW Local News Hour, my first guest is Drew Frink. He's the Director of Technology and Assessment for the Park City School District. He is here to talk about SAGE testing results from last school year. The prior year, one of Park City schools received a failing overall grade, which was related to a very large number of students who opted out of the test. Welcome, Drew. Thanks for coming by.
Good morning, Carolyn. Thanks for having me.
So just for a little background on this, because I know a lot of people in the community were very worked up about that. Can you kind of give a little background on just what had occurred with that failing grade that Treasure Mountain had received last year
or the year before? So one of the challenges we've had with the SAGE test in particular is a part of Utah law that very clearly allows parents to opt their students out of any state assessment. And unfortunately, at our three secondary schools, we've had a fairly high level of opt-outs over the last couple of years. Ecker and Treasure were at about 25%, and the high school last year was almost 50%. And when you look at that from any kind of statistical standpoint, that really makes those overall scores very difficult to consider representative. And we really believe that's what happened last year at Treasure Mountain. Is between that and I think the fact that some students realized if they didn't take the test seriously, it didn't matter to them, that's where we wound up. So the team at Treasure did a huge, great job last year of really trying to boost the importance of the test and how important it is for the students to take it seriously. They actually cut their opt-out rate in half. It's still high at about 12%, but much better. So I think that's why we saw real improvements there. At Treasure this year was because of that work that the admin team and their teachers and their PTO did.
So are the opt-out rates comparable to other schools that are similar to Park City in the state?
We have been the highest in the state for the last couple of years. We actually lost that mantle this year, which made me proud. But for the previous 2 years, we were number one in the state for traditional high schools.
Okay, so feedback has been given to the State Board of Education. There have been some changes made for last year's testing.
Yes.
Analysis is my understanding. So can you talk a little bit about those changes and what that means? And
So one of the changes you'll see if you look at the Utah's school report cards this year is that there are no grades. In past years, because it is in legislation, every school gets a letter grade, just like we all did when we were in school, in my case, many years ago, that was removed this year in part because of some changes in the testing. We have new 6-8 science standards that were put in place last year. So they had to do some work around those tests to make sure once they were taken that they'd done all the sort of psychometric work on them. So that was part of why, and also given the change that we're going through now with new testing this year, the state board was able to remove those letter grades. And I actually think that was a real improvement in the system. I look at it this way. If you took your car in and they, you know, for service and they said, okay, your car is a B, I would want to know more specifically what part of it. Is it the brakes? Is it the door? So I think having the state is going in a nice direction now with having a bit of a broader look at performance and growth and readiness for college. There's still a ways to go, I think. And unfortunately, this report has changed every year, which makes it a little challenging for the community to get a feel for it. So I'm hoping now maybe going forward we'll be able to settle down and have consistency year to year, so we'll really be able to understand it.
Okay, what year are we in for SAGE testing?
This was the fifth year we just finished,
okay.
And that's part of why we are switching to new test systems, because the contract ended.
So
the state did a new RFP system and came up with new vendors.
Okay, and so this next statewide testing system, will it be more useful?
I think it will be. We actually have two new systems for grades 3 through 8. It's called the RISE system. It will be somewhat similar to the old SAGE tests, similar sort of questions. We're beginning to get a feel for how it works. We have some elementary schools doing some initial benchmark testing right now, which gives us a chance to kind of get a feel for how the questions work. And it looks really good. The one I'm really excited about is the new 9-10 test. It's called Utah Aspire Plus. And that is directly related to ACT. So eventually that will be predictive for students of their likely ACT scores. So we expect to see some of that prediction this year. As always with a new test, it may take a year or two for all the math to get done. But if nothing else, it is excellent practice because it's the same sort of timed environment. So I think for those ninth and 10th graders, it's a great free way to get through that ACT experience before they have to take it for real.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's been a conversation for decades about standardized tests and how useful they are and whether it's a good use of our students' time and our teachers' time. Do these tests, when they're selected by the State Board of mm-hmm. Education, do they look at strategic plan overall of what is the state trying to achieve? And like, especially with us, we have, you know, our strategic plan is pretty firmly in place at this point.
Yes.
You know, excellence in education, success in academics, leadership, communication, community alliances. Does it really support those elements?
So I can't speak directly to the state's thing since I wasn't part of that process, but I do know some of the assessment directors who were on that, and they are career dedicated educators. So I know they were thinking of those things. You know, part of my philosophy around assessment is that it is critical to good instruction. And when we think sort of educational theory, the first two questions we ask are, one is, what do students need to know? And the second question is, how do we know that they know it? So if we don't do that piece, all we're doing is talking. We're not really teaching. So, but there's always a bit of a back and forth between the amount of time and effort an assessment takes and instructional time. But good assessment is part of good instructional time.
And it measures a student's or a school's, I guess. You're looking at a school overall, but it measures its progress.
Yeah, it gives us a good data point to go forward. And really, you know, another part of assessment is you're looking at both on an individual student level. It's important to have that sort of outside look at what a student actually knows, and looking at on a school or a program level to see, hey, we've made a change. We're working hard in a particular area. Are we seeing any results? And that's where I'm excited because the new state tests, they went with a 10-year contract. I mean, they have plenty of outs if there are issues, but that will give us stability. Because any new system, it'll take us a few years to iron out all the little bugs and crinkles. And then we can just sort of settle in and have good data going forward. And that good information allows us to make good instructional decisions. That's ultimately what this is all about.
So for administering that test, does it take a lot of added extra energy on the part of our educators to prepare students for that? Or
There's somewhat. I mean, we're already doing this. The tests are all based on the Utah core standards, which is what we're teaching. So we're not trying to teach directly to a test. We are doing some work, particularly in the elementary schools right now, with beginning to play with some of the practice tests and the smaller benchmarks to get the students used to the system. And some of this is also new for us as well. These are two new testing systems. No two systems work the same way. So we're learning right now all the ins and outs. And so it'll be a big lift this year just because it's new. And give us a year or so and we'll be settled in and be able to do it efficiently.
And as far as the results from this last year of SAGE testing, mm-hmm. what are the valuable things that you're able to draw from that in terms of going forward?
Yeah, so when we look overall, one thing I do keep in mind, again, talking about opt-out rates, that I don't look very closely at our three secondary schools to draw too many conclusions because of the high numbers. I mean, we're looking at, you know, anywhere between 12 and 34% opting out at those three schools, which makes using that data a challenge. The elementary schools have much lower rates. And one thing we were really excited about this year was science at elementary schools. And even Jeremy Ranch, which has for the last few years been a really strong science school, even they saw some growth, which is wonderful. So we're looking at that as a real win for us this year. And so some of this is, we also look at, you know, we look at some individual student information, but we do that all in the fall because we have access to some of the raw data much sooner than the published information. So we're able to make some decisions when students are coming back to school.
Are the state tests offered in the Spanish language?
At this point, they are not, to the best of my knowledge. We've had discussions about that internally with some of our internal testing, particularly when you're looking at math and science testing, where we're really interested in knowing what they know about the content and less about their language skills. But the other part of it is a big part of their language acquisition is developing that academic vocabulary, which is so critical. So that is part of what those, even a science test in English is letting us know is, hey, is this, has the student picked up that necessary science vocabulary that they need to have, even beyond just the content?
Okay, so like an English, if you have a school like, say, McPolin, where you have a higher percentage of English language learners,
yes,
typically, will those scores be impacted? Will it? I mean, is there something that you have to do in order to anticipate this? And
it is definitely a factor. I know that Principal Edmiston at McPolin, I mean, he and his staff are incredibly dedicated and really believe in the work that they're doing. They have a very diverse population, high levels of low-income students and English language learners, but they're really working to build a strong community. And a point that he made to me once in a discussion was, you know, one of the things you can do when you look at our school system is when you look at our high school and all the good work they do there, particularly their ability to graduate students, have people ready for college and careers, that's not only a reflection of that high school staff, but also of the whole system. Because if our elementary schools weren't doing their jobs, it would show through the whole system. So I think we have a lot to be proud of. And we know we have areas to improve. I mean, the folks I work with are constantly looking at every little area to see, hey, okay, what's going on over here? Was this just a one-off fluke, or is this an issue we need to work on?
Right. Were there any schools in the district that were of concern?
Well, I mean, there's always, you know, this year when you look at the scores for McPolin, they weren't where we would have liked them to be. And, you know, Principal Edmiston has looked at that and also understands that, you know, they are our only full DLI school. So all school DLI. So that's really been their focus, has been that more on the testing. I think they do a lot of work with building community in that school to help those students feel empowered. And he loves the fact that, you know, at any point in the day, you know, a good half of their population is learning a new language, which is an amazing skill to be developing, and it really helps to bring that school together. So we're excited about what's going there, but we're always looking at those performance scores and saying, okay, is there something more?
And will the opt-out situation continue? I mean, what with the next 10 years, students can still opt out.
They can still opt out. I mean, you will be hearing a lot from us over the next few months, from myself and from our communications folks, as we're going to do everything we can to get the word out for how these tests can be useful for your students and for our schools, and to do what we can. I mean, ultimately, parents have that right, and I definitely respect that. That is important in this state. But we're going to do everything we can to convince you to, you know, give it your best go, and I think it can be useful for all of us.
How long are the tests?
They're, you know, different lengths. A couple of usually 45 to an hour, maybe an hour and a half for each piece. We're still learning some of that information, and again, these are two new tests. So while we have some estimates from the state, we'll know more once we do them once.
Okay. And so, anything else you want to say about the state testing?
I don't think so. I mean, we're excited to looking forward into the future now that we have a test that we can settle in on for a few years, that we're just going to get down to work and do the good work we do working with our kids.
Okay. What's the time of year where they're taken?
It's in the spring. So okay. I think most of them start right after April break.
And then typically you get results in over the fall timeframe?
Yeah, we'll have some raw results right away, and then we'll get the final stuff. We expect to see the state release in the fall. It was late this year because of science.
Okay. Hey, thank you so much, Drew, for coming by.
Thanks, Carolyn. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. It's 8:31. My next guest is Kelly Gallo. She's from the Summit County Health Department. Well, it appears state regulators have recently reported that one of three homes in Utah has elevated levels of radon. And I have Kelly Gallo here to talk about this recent report. It's an odorless, tasteless gas, and it's the leading cause of lung cancer for non-smokers, is my understanding. Welcome, Kelly. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for letting me talk about radon today.
Yeah, so can you talk about why we have so much radon in our homes in Utah, for starters?
Well, this is just a naturally occurring gas. It seeps into our homes through cracks and crevices in our foundation. The only way that you're going to know whether you really do have that within your home is if you test for it.
And is it a gas that's in the soil?
Yes, it's uranium as it decays. And so the the gases are just naturally there, and they'll rise up within your home.
Okay, and you can do a test. You can. I've done a test. I have gone to Home Depot and bought a radon kit and send it in. Is that what is still recommended homeowners?
It's simple. It's inexpensive. You can come over to the health department and buy one for $10. You can go to your local hardware store. Most of them have them, and they're very inexpensive. You can even go online to the Department of Environmental Quality's website, and they have discounted test kits for residents. Just takes about 3 days. Send it in the mail. They'll tell you what your results are.
Okay, and would a community like Park City, where we've got this mining heritage, would we tend to have higher levels than other parts of the state, or is that not so much an issue? There's uranium basically everywhere throughout the state, and it's decaying.
There's uranium throughout the state. We do. The really interesting thing about it is that your neighbor could have low levels and you could have high levels. So, yes, Park City does happen to have some higher levels. But if you look throughout the state, you'll find that there are other pockets that also have high levels.
So in Summit County, we mirror what the rest of the state is, that 1 in 3 homes would have radon.
Absolutely.
Levels. Are there any levels that are safe levels?
The EPA recommends that you mitigate for radon in your home if you have a level of 4 picocuries or higher. So anything lower than that, they're essentially saying that you can watch those levels and continue to test and just make sure. Wintertime is the best time to test, so that's why January is Radon Action Month, just putting that information out there, letting people know that this is an issue and that it's a very preventable way to try to save your family from lung cancer.
And why is the winter better?
Our homes are closed up. We don't have that great ventilation going on that helps to move the air within our homes. So if you spend time in your lower areas of your home, you definitely want to be considering testing. And with levels like 1 in 3 homes having it, all of us should be testing.
Mm-hmm. And so what does the test involve?
It's just a small little kit. You open it up, there's a little pad in there, you hang it up anywhere from 2 to 6 feet off of the floor, keeping it at least 3 feet away from appliances and doors and walls and ceilings, things like that. Leave it out for about 3 days, put it back, seal up the package. You just write all your information for the lab right on the outside of that package, drop it in the mail, and they'll contact you with your results.
Okay, and how often should people test?
I would definitely be considering once a year if you haven't done it yet. Right now is a really perfect time to be checking those levels. You can check them seasonally if you prefer to, especially if you've taken a test at another time of the year in the past. It's worth checking.
And what does a homeowner do to mitigate it if they find they do have radon?
It's relatively simple when you consider household expenses. You can have a mitigator come in. They'll drill a hole underneath the foundation of your home. They'll put a pipe up through that. The radon then seeps, the gases seep into that hole, and that pipe will ventilate it out through your house. The pipe goes up above the level of your highest level of your home. And they find that that will bring your radon levels down considerably very quickly. So okay. Relatively inexpensive, simple, great way to prevent lung cancer in your family.
Mm-hmm. And who would do a job like that? I mean, who do people call for that?
You can take a look at DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality's website. They have a list of certified radon mitigators here in the state of Utah.
And it seems like if 1 in 3 homes have it, what is the role of public health to alert people to this potential danger? What should be happening with the Environmental Protection Agency, both on a federal and a state level?
It's what Radon Action Month is all about, is just outreach and really trying to get the information out there. I know that on a personal level, I had often thought, well, this really isn't that big of a deal. We're not home that often. We don't live in the bottom floor. And then I heard about pets who live at home all day long and who are exposed to radon all day long. And my dogs are there on that first floor all the time. So we're currently testing with a long-term monitor just to see what we have. So I think that folks just need to become more aware about it. They need to think about how it fits into their day-to-day life and really be serious about testing your homes mm-hmm. and mitigating if it's necessary.
And what is a long-term monitor?
It stays up for about 3 months. It's just a little bit more expensive. It's about $25. And it will collect that data over a longer amount of time, give you a much better understanding of what your levels really are within your home.
Wouldn't it just make sense to maybe contact the contractors that would go ahead and insert a hole in a pipe and just do that to be on the safe side? Is it super expensive to have that kind of a project done?
No, it's about $1,500 to $3,000, but for some families, it's just not viable. And if that's an expense that they can save on, it might be better put towards other indoor air quality mitigation or any other number of things that they need to do for their own health.
Okay. Anything else you want to say about radon in our homes?
Just like to reiterate that radon claims 21,000 lives in the U.S. each year. It's something that a lot of us don't know about and think about, and now is a perfect time to test. So consider coming over to the Summit County Health Department and getting a test, your local hardware store, or go to DEQ's website, to their radon program, and you'll be able to just order one online right there.
Oh, okay. Great. Thank you, Kelly Gallo. Kelly is in from the Summit County Health Department talking about radon this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Good morning. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. It is 8:39 going on. 8:40. Here we have it. We've got Cheryl Fox. She's the executive director of the Summit Land Conservancy. Welcome. Thanks for coming by this morning.
Good morning.
So you had a big year last year. You closed 5 transactions. You supported the treasure bond. You're continuing to put money towards the Osgathorpe Farm Conservation easement out on Old Ranch Road. And it sounds like there is a fun event going on this weekend to help elevate awareness of just how nice it is out there.
You're exactly right, Carolyn. We're really fortunate. The Osgathorpe family has offered to open the farm on Old Ranch Road for cross-country skiing on Saturday. That's this Saturday, January 12th. It will be open from 10 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon. We're asking people to park at Willow Creek, and the Summit Land Conservancy has a van so we can shuttle people over, because there's no place to park over there on Old Ranch Road. You know, we don't want to congest that area. So park at Willow Creek, and we'll shuttle people over in the van. It's a big, beautiful, snow-covered parcel of land, and it's flat. And, you know, one of the things that I hear a lot from people who cross-country ski, myself included, you know, I'm a downhill skier. I've been a downhill skier most of my life. I do not know how to stop those cross-country skis when I'm coming downhill in Round Valley. And it's always a little bit harrowing. And then, you know, the dog gets in the way. And anyway, on the land that we're going to have open this Saturday, it's flat. It's a great opportunity for people to come out and see what might be possible out there. We are super grateful to the Osgathorpe family who is offering this. This is free. It's open to the public. Anybody can come. We're also incredibly grateful and indebted to our friends at Mountain Trails Foundation, who have gone out and groomed the property. So there will be 3 or 4K groomed, kind of a loop, so that people can see, you know, once you get out on the property and you just see how big it is and the views from all around, it's really stunning. So I hope people will take the opportunity. You know, it's just a little test. It's not really an opportunity to come out probably and train for the Olympics, but it would certainly be a nice opportunity for people to come out and just see what might happen out there.
Sure. And will we have groomed skiing track as well as classic, or they stick him with just one?
I think it's, you know, people can probably skate on it if they'd like. It's not a terribly wide track. So, yeah, but I mean, people can do whatever they would like. But I think, you know, again, this is a test run. So I know sometimes out in Round Valley and in other places, people, you know, are really working on getting their heart rate up and that kind of thing. This is a little more exploration and fun and just enjoying this amenity out there.
Okay, sure. So give us an update on where things are on in terms of hitting your goal. It's a March goal? Isn't that what we're looking for?
The cooperative agreement that we have with the federal government for the $8.8 million says that the deal should close at the end of March. At this point, we are aiming for that goal because that's what that cooperative agreement says. That's what the family would like to do. That's what the Conservancy would like to do. As we all know, the federal government is in flux at the moment, so we're not sure if they will be able to uphold their end. That's not the right way to put it. We're not sure that they will be able to get it done with the March deadline, given all of the other things that are now backed up because they've been, you know, on limited capabilities over the last couple of weeks. So, you know, we had two other conservation easements using federal funding that were supposed to close at the end of December, and they were not able to get closed in part because of the government shutdown. So, you know, we're still working through with our partners at the federal government. They're kind of understaffed in the first place, and so it's just hard for them to always meet the deadlines that are required by their own cooperative agreement. So we're moving forward in anticipation of that. So, you know, that's 3 months.
Are you still raising money, though, for the
purchase? We are absolutely still raising money. This is not a done deal. We keep saying that over and over again. You know, we're still looking at about $1.6 million that we need to raise. We did a mailer that went out that generated a lot of support at the end of the year, which was really fabulous. But we do need a handful of people to kind of come to the table and say, yes, we are going to save this farm.
Okay. And what happens if the 1.6 is not raised by March? And I mean, it sounds like possibly the government shutdown could be to our benefit if Summit Land is trying to,
you know, yes and no.
Delay things.
In terms of fundraising, you know, more time doesn't always get you more money. It just exhausts everybody. So, and in truth, the family, if you'll remember a year ago when the family had this huge obligation that they had to pay in March last year, and they were trying to figure out what to do, and we thought we would be able to have, you know, a good portion of our portion at the table. The Summit Land Conservancy wasn't able to do that for a variety of reasons, so the family took out loans in order to keep the conservation transaction alive. Well, they're paying... They make big interest payments every month on those loans. So basically what they did with those loans is they bought us a year to try to get this transaction done. So if we're going to extend it further, you know, that's a real cost to the family that they didn't anticipate when they started this transaction. So in order to be fair to them, we really are pushing to get it done.
Okay. And what can people do if they're interested in participating?
So you can just show up on Saturday morning or, you know, anytime between 10 and 1 o'clock on Saturday. Again, park at Willow Creek Park and we'll shuttle you over. There's, like I said, no cost. Just come, have fun, say hello. You know, it's the family's way a little bit of saying thank you to the community. We've had over 700 gifts for this project. So I think that just shows that this project is really cherished. This open space is really cherished by the community as a farm, and this is a way the family is able to say, you know, come and share this with us. And again, we're so grateful to Mountain Trails for taking the time to groom it for us.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just free, open to the public.
Okay, and Summit Land has another moonshine event coming up?
That's right. During the winter months, actually and summer months, we offer people the opportunity to get out and look at our open spaces under a different light, and that is the moonlight. And so on the full moons in the summer and the winter, we have what we call our moonshine adventures. In the winter, we do them in conjunction again with our friends at Mountain Trails. And the next one is on the full moon on January 22nd, so right before sundance. They meet at the base of the Park City Mountain Resort, and they skin up and they ski down. So people need to bring their own equipment to hike up the mountain, and good headlamps and, you know, some water and things like that. But it's a really cool event, really fun. And, you know, we usually get 25, 30, 50, even sometimes 50 people who come out. So seeing everybody with their headlights, it's really interesting. It's really cool.
Great. Thank you, Cheryl Fox, Executive Director of the Summit Land Conservancy.
Thank you.
Listening to the Local News Hour, my next guests include Ms. Ashley Mott, who is the dance teacher at Park City High School, and she's here with two seniors from the high school, and they're going to talk about their performance coming up, which is called Informants. And the students I have here are April Byes and Juliana Klug. They're both seniors with the dance company, too. Do I have that right? And you have been a part of the creation, production, and choreography of this program that is happening next week. They've choreographed the dances, from what I understand. You're both advertising, posters, publicity. You've edited videos. You've produced the project from start to finish. You and, I guess, a team of you. So welcome. And boy, that's impressive.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for having us on.
You're welcome. So let me ask you, Ms. Mott, did these guys get a grade for this? And how do you begin to grade it?
Yes, absolutely. So many of the components of this project are related to our state and national curriculum for dance in the schools, which includes collaboration, creating, responding, performing. So they're hitting many of the priority standards for dance education.
Okay. And tell me, April, how did you decide on the theme?
So we had kind of a group brainstorm, and we're all thinking of concepts we wanted to work with and things we wanted to discuss and teach about and learn more about. And then we eventually decided on learning about dance concepts called Bartinia Fundamentals and Laban Movement. And then we were pairing that with emotion and exploring how body articulation relates to different emotion and where that stems from in your body and how you show that.
And what is the theme called? What are you calling
it? It's called
this?
Emotions of Dance.
Emotions of Dance. Okay. And let's talk about that movement. And I guess that is related to the choreography. Juliana, were you part of that process?
Yes. So when we pick movements for each emotion piece for our dance, we have to consider which emotion would best suit each Bartinia Fundamental and Laban movement. So different ways that you can express your body language can show how you feel and what emotion you are trying to present. For example, like if you were scared, you might want to curl up in a ball and be very inward. And that's one movement that we have that we've been working with and understanding. Whereas, like, if you were trying to show a happy emotion, it would be one that we call core distal, where you come in and then burst out, where it's like you're happy and you're trying to show it. So okay. That's what we've been working with.
And the choreography, who is doing that? Are they dancers who are doing the
yes,
choreography?
Yes, all the dancers on our company have been doing choreography for every piece. We have a couple pieces that are done by guest choreographers that are like by professional dancers, and then some pieces from the other dance company. But most of them are done by us and dance company too.
Okay. And there are six dances, six emotions that you're representing with the performance?
We have six main dances for the emotions, but we do have the other ones like from the guest choreographers and from the other company that we include as part of each section for the emotions. So one piece that we have in the beginning where we have our whole company dancing together, we place it under an emotion so it still goes together, but it's still like separate from our specific dance that we choreographed for it.
Okay, and how, let's go back to you, April. How do the dancers get trained? Who's training? Who's teaching? Is it Ms. Mott who goes in and takes care of that aspect?
Or? It's a little bit of both. So a lot of it is very student-driven, and she will go around and we will come up with the pieces and the movements that we think go with our emotion, and then she'll video us and give us notes and then see how it works, but it's always a work in progress.
Okay, and you've made some videos. I watched one of the marketing videos that was put together, and we'll include that on our website after we've posted this interview. But how did that come about? Who decided that they could, you know, run the video equipment and produce that part of it?
It was all part of the assignment. So we have videos as part of the informants as well, explaining the dance concepts that we're doing in between our pieces. And then the information video was also part of that project. So it's all the students are doing it.
Okay. And what did you have a favorite part of the whole process, Juliana?
Probably my favorite part, which goes with any time that I work with the dancers in my company, is just the collaboration for each piece, because it's really interesting. I mean, it's always fun to choreograph something by yourself, but it's something else to choreograph it with other people, because you get to see what their style is like and you get to incorporate it all into one piece that you get to dance together. We're really big on community in dance company and dance company too, so just having the opportunity to work with the other girls on projects like this is a really nice experience.
And would you bring in other students from other departments to be a part of it, or was this all basically your crew, your dance team?
It was our dance team. Okay. Well, aside from when we do like productions, we can have like the stage tech kids help us with like lighting, all that kind of stuff. But as far as like doing the dances, it's all on the dance company.
Okay. Well, let's get a rundown of all the details. When and what time and where and...
So our informants, Emotions of Dance, will be on Tuesday, January 15th. So this coming week, there are two shows that are open to the public. There's a show at 5:30 p.m. and at 7 o'clock p.m. Both of those shows are showing in the Black Box Theater at the Eccles Center at the high school. All these students will also be performing two other shows that day for InReach, which is like an outreach, but the students come to us. So that morning, all of the fifth grade classes from Parley's Park Elementary School will bus in to see our informants. That afternoon, some select students from Treasure Mountain Junior High School will be walking over to see our informants. So the dancers are actually doing four runs of their show in one day. So they have a 9:20 a.m. for PPES, a 1:20 p.m. for TMJH, and then the two public shows at 5:30 and 7 o'clock p.m.
Okay.
All of those shows are free and open to the public. We do invite a suggested $5 donation, but that's not required. That's just to help us cover the costs of programs and posters and costumes.
Okay. How long will the performance last?
We think that the show is going to run approximately 1 hour. We actually have our first complete run through of the entire show with both companies and videos and stage crew on Monday at dress rehearsal. So up until this point, we've run sections with different groups, but we have yet to run the entire show. My estimate is that the show will run approximately 1 hour with
okay.
no intermission.
Wow. Well, it sounds to me like some of your team are going to need some sport legs, for one thing, as well as hydration over the weekend and lots of sleep and good nutritious food. Okay. Wow. That's quite an undertaking. You're going to be exhausted by the time Wednesday rolls around.
I think exhausted, but also so excited. I think the adrenaline and the joy of seeing such a big project come together and they finally get to execute it and share it with audiences and friends and families is sort of what helps keep them afloat,
sure.
as well as what you mentioned, which is good self-care and nutrition and sleep.
Yes, yes. That's great. Let me ask just before you go, how long have you been working on this?
It's been around...
at least a couple months.
Yeah, so we've been working on it quite a while. However, when we first started working on it, we, of course, had, like, other projects or, like, competition working on other dance pieces that we were doing. So it hasn't been, like, straight working on it the entire time. But then I think when we started to really, like, start working on it, I would say it would be, like, around November.
Okay.
So that's good.
Okay, well... have a great time. Good luck with everything.
Thank you so much.
That is Juliana Klug and April Byes, both seniors at Park City High School, along with their dance teacher, Ms. Ashley Mott. Thank you for coming by, ladies.
Thank you so much.